It's October 7, 2010, in Radha Desh, we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Talks Between Narada and King Vrijamavargi, Text 52. So this is, it's concluding one section and starting another. So you remember that Narada went on his own to speak to King Vrijamavargi, to instruct him to give up materialistic activities. He spoke this whole story of King Puranjana, and then the king said, what was the king's main question after he finished this whole allegory?
He said, I'm a very simple person, I can't really understand this.
Right, what does it mean?
Can you explain it?
Explain it. So now Narada's gone through the analysis. Now he didn't always have to do that. With the sons of Daksha, he didn't have to explain anything. He just says, there's a wheel, there's a hole, there's a lady, there's a man, there's... Okay, bhakti. So, with King Vrijamavargi, now Narada is going through the whole explanation. Now he's finished. But when he finishes the explanation, he sees that there's still a problem. So then we're coming to today's verse. And if we look at this verse, what words here do you immediately understand? Of course, Narada Uvacha, everybody understands. I hope, right?
Prashna
means what?
Question.
Okay, anything else here?
Sanchina. China is something to cut.
Okay. Guyam?
Secret. Adata is saying something also.
Adata? Yes. Yes, Mr. Tem, yes. Without doubt. Without chincha, yes. Therefore. As it is, or here.
Me and
me. Evam and he.
Purushashiva Pesto.
Yeah. Purusha Rishava. Rishava means the top, great, like King, like Maharaj Rishabha. So Purusha Rishabha, the top person. Narada Uvacha.
Narada Uvacha.
Prashna evami sanchino.
Prashna evami sanchino.
Bhavata purushar sabha.
Bhavata purushar sabha.
Atrame vadato guyam.
Atrame vadato guyam.
Nishamaya sunishchitam.
Narada Uvacha.
Prashna evami sanchino. Bhavata purusha. Why am I struggling so much? Bhavata purusharshu. Now, you know what? Just chant. It's not a good day for me with Sanskrit. Why don't you guys just chant? Have a bad Sanskrit
day.
Prashna evam
Kishan.
Uvacha. Narada said, Prashnaha, question, evam, thus, he, certainly, Sanchinaha, answered, Bhavataha, your, Purusha Rishabha, O great personality, Atra, here, me Vadataha, as I am speaking, Guyam, confidential, Nishamaya, here, Sunishchitam, perfectly ascertained. Translation. The great saint Narada continued, O great personality, I have replied properly about all that you have asked me. Now hear another narration that is accepted by saintly persons and is very confidential. So you may wonder, well, if Narada Muni's already gave the king all instruction, answered all the king's questions, why is he going to speak something else? Why isn't he just say, okay, now we're done? So why would a teacher go on after so-called finishing the class?
To reinforce what you already said.
To reinforce, why? What would impel the teacher to want to reinforce?
A question which would mean that a person did not understand things clearly?
Definitely. So if the students asked a question that indicated they did not yet understand, but here we don't see that the king is asking a question. So that would be a definite reason. But what other reasons? In the absence of the student saying something.
Difficulty in presentation.
Some difficulty in presentation. How would you tell this? There's some problem on the part of the student, right?
Yeah.
So how is the teacher understanding this? So there's some relationship. What sort of symptom? If the student's not asking anything.
Silence,
right? We can think about Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya when he was speaking for 7 days and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't say anything. And then he said, have you understood anything I said? Now we're going to see here what prompts Narada Muni to continue. That's what's discussed in this purport, which is based very closely on Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport. Purport. Sri Narada Muni is personally acting as the spiritual master of King Bharishma. It was Narada Muni's intention that through his instructions, the king would immediately give up all engagement in fruitive activity and take to devotional service. So what was Narada Muni's assessment procedure? Because the way you know whether or not you're a good teacher is how well your students do on the tests. That's how you judge your teaching. So what was the test? What was Narada Muni looking for? What was his learning objective? Yes. Yes. If King Bharishman or Prachini Bharisha, if he were to have given up fruitive activities, that was the assessment. It was a very experiential assessment. It wasn't a written exam, and he wasn't presenting a project, but he was expected to do something. And when did Narada Muni expect him to do this? What was the word Prabhupada used here?
Immediately.
Immediately. So basically, Narada Muni expected him to jump up and do something immediately. It was Narada Muni's intention, so this is Narada Muni's learning objective. I'm very, very serious. He has his learning objective, which is you're all interested in teaching, right? And learning. That's okay? I can talk. Teaching talk. Is that okay? Okay. So your learning objective and your assessment should be almost equal. We should all have learning objectives for ourselves also. Now, how do you know when you've reached the goal you want to reach? You have some sort of assessment procedure. Now, how do you know that the planes landed in Brussels? Once when I was flying in Russia from St. Petersburg to Moscow, that was quite an experience. It was a handwritten boarding pass, and all in Russian. And then all the announcements were only in Russian. They didn't have, you know, most of the world, they respect that we Americans are supreme in the world, and they make sure English is a second language. Although maybe the Britishers think that's because they think Britain is still supreme in the world, I'm not sure. But in Russia, they had no such, you know, respect, intimate respect. So only in Russian. And the signs are only in Russian, and it's a completely different alphabet. So, you know, if something's in French, you can sort of make it out if you know English, but Russian, forget it. And I went to the gate they told me to go to, and I just go up to the person at the gate, and I said, you know, I showed them my boarding pass, and she just said, wait. Actually, I thought she said Kuwait. Maybe this is a gate for Kuwait. You know, I wasn't sure what to do. And they wouldn't help me, and I'm just sitting there, and meanwhile the time for my plane to take off is expiring. Nothing's happening at the gate. And then I see the person who'd written in my boarding pass was sitting in the middle of the room taking people's boarding passes and directing them down the hallway. And I thought, maybe that's where I'm supposed to go. And I go up to her, and I just hand her my boarding pass. She doesn't say a word and just looks at it and points that way. Must be the right place, although it wasn't the right gate at all, and I went to a completely different building. And there again, there was different gates, and everything's in Russian, and I'm kind of looking around, and I think that says Moscow in Russian, I'm not sure, you know. And when they started boarding at that gate, I went on that plane, and no one even looked at my boarding pass. And then I get on the plane, and there's not even an announcement as to where we're going, and I'm sitting there thinking, I don't know where you're taking me, Lord, but I hope it's going to be fun. So, thankfully, both I and my luggage did get to Moscow. But generally, if we want to go someplace, we have some sort of assessment procedures, right? You know the different steps. Okay, I'm at the right gate, I'm getting on the right plane, right? Or if you're driving, there's some sign, so many more kilometers to go. You have to keep checking that you're on the right path. So if you're directing yourself, you have to have self-assessment procedures. In business, they call this benchmarks. I don't know why, it must come from some old thing for craftspeople who made some mark on a bench. And for a teacher also should have assessment procedures. Right? Know where you're going, notice whether or not you're getting there, and if you're not getting there, change. Right? Very simple, if you can understand the simple formula. Your life will be successful. Seriously, not joking. Know where you're supposed to be going. Notice whether or not you're getting there, and if you're not, change something. So Narada Muni is the teacher. He knows where he wants to go. Where does he want to go? What does he want his student? What's his assessment procedure? Stop fruit of activities when? Immediately. Okay, so that's not happening. Maybe the king's just still sitting there nodding and smiling or something, but he's not doing anything. Yeah, going on with the purport. However, although the king understood everything, he was still not prepared to give up his engagements. And somebody asked this question the other day, and I'm here today. Suppose that we have faith that we should surrender to Krishna, but we don't surrender. Remember that question? So here it says the king understood, but he wasn't prepared to act on his understanding. He had just theoretical understanding. As the following verses will show, the king was contemplating sending for his sons, who are away from home executing austerities and penances. After their return, he would entrust his kingdom to them and then leave home. So the king's thinking, okay, now I agree with Narada, so what I'll do, my sons are out performing austerities. I'll stop them. I'll have them stop now. Have them come home. I'll instruct them, turn over everything to them, settle everything, and then I'll take up Narada's instructions. This is the position of most people. Now Prabhupada's taking this idea and applying it to us. They accept a bona fide spiritual master and listen to him, But when the spiritual master indicates that they should leave home and fully engage in devotional service, they hesitate. Now, we think of all the times, you know, when we read something in Prabhupada's purports, or we listen to a lecture, or we hear something from our guru or our authorities, and we're like, yes, but I don't know if I'm quite ready to do that today. The duty of the spiritual master is to instruct the disciple as long as he does not come to the understanding that this materialistic way of life, fruit of activity, is not at all beneficial. So in other words, the teacher's duty is to keep going until they achieve their assessment criteria. And this is a very important point for teachers. One of the first things that I teach, I have a seminar, I teach a seven-part seminar, and the first thing that we instruct is that whether or not the students learn is the responsibility of the teacher. Now, really, is that absolutely true? No. In fact, Narada tried to instruct Daksha, and he was not successful. And we don't blame Narada. We don't say there's something wrong with Narada's teaching methods, that Daksha didn't listen. So ultimately, the responsibility for learning is the students. However, the teacher should not have that mentality. The teacher has the mentality that I am responsible. I am responsible. If my students are not learning, then I have to change something. And I have to adjust something. I may come with the best plan, and if it's not working, I change. And we see that Srila Prabhupada did that over and over and over again. He would try different things for ISKCON, try different managerial policies or this or that. When it didn't work, he would change. When it wasn't getting the result that he wanted, he would make some adjustment. And he did that also in dealing with individuals. I'd like you to do this. No, I don't think I can do that. Okay, now why don't you do this? Or we saw yesterday, Gopamoyi was speaking about this narrative with Dhruva. He gave Dhruva an instruction. Dhruva said, I can't do that. He said, okay, do this. And Krishna does that in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Best if you do that. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. And so we adjust. There's a tendency sometimes not to adjust. You know, I'm trying to make my point. I'm trying to teach something. We see this with parents a lot also, you know. They punish the kid. The kid doesn't change. And what do? Punish more. They never think, well, maybe I should try something else. It's something like we used to show a lot of devotional movies in Hindi with English subtitles. And one time I got one of these films and I turned it on and I thought, oh, the volume's not loud enough, I can't hear it. And I realized this one didn't have subtitles, it was just Hindi. You know, and we think like that sometimes. You know, if someone doesn't know English and you speak to them in English and they don't respond, you just talk louder. You just repeat it. You just repeat over and over again what you're saying. I saw this very unfortunately at a seminar given in Russia where the speaker was speaking on envy, and her first point was the difference between jealousy and envy. And the translator stopped her and said, in Russia there's only one word. And she had a whole, like 15, 20 minutes of her presentation was planned on this point. And she kept trying to force it. You know, 5 minutes at least she was trying to force it. Well, you must have some way. And the translator said, no, we don't. You know, I had a similar opposite experience recently where, I don't remember where it was. Oh, Hungary. And I was trying to use the word attachment to mean both the hand being attached to the body and us becoming attached to Krishna. And the translator looked at me and said, we have two different words for that in Hungarian. It's not, you're not going to be able to make your point. And then you kind of go, oh, what's my plan B? Yeah. So a good teacher should always have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. And you notice Krishna in our lives always has a plan B and a plan C. Like those really good GPSs. I don't know what you call them. Sat-navs, tom-toms. What do you call those things? GPS, okay. So if you, and I'm not accustomed to using them. I was using one in San Diego, and it said, turn right in 200 yards. And I didn't. I missed the turn, and I thought, in the old-fashioned way, I thought, oh, now I got to get off the highway and turn around and go back. And then it said, recalculating your route. And it gave me plan B, where I didn't have to backtrack. I thought, oh, that's cool. So the real guru and Krishna, they always have, and they notice. They're paying attention. They notice. So Narada noticed that this king, although he understood. Now, interesting that Narada Muni's assessment wasn't only does he understand, but what does he do? So we find so many times people understand and they don't do. Okay, so they accept a bona fide spiritual master, listen to him, but when the spiritual master indicates that they should leave home and fully engage in devotional service, they hesitate. The duty of the spiritual master is to instruct the disciple as long as he does not come to the understanding that this materialistic way of life, root of activity, is not beneficial. So the lesson's not over until the student gets it. It's not that you say, okay, I did my best, walk away, it's not my responsibility anymore. Actually, once you take to devotional service from the beginning of life, so you might, because you might say, well, why should the king take it up immediately? Prabhupada says, really, you should do that from the beginning. As Prahlad Maharaj advises, Komara Acharet Prajno Dharman Bhagavatam Iha, Bhagavatam 7.6.1. According to all the instructions of the Vedas, we can understand that unless one takes to Krishna consciousness and devotional service, he's simply wasting his time engaging in the fruitive activities of material existence. So here now, just in case we're not convinced, Prabhupada's emphasizing to us why the king should give up fruitive activities. Narada Muni therefore decided to relate another allegory to the king so that he might be induced to give up family life within material existence. So Narada Muni's figured out that this king, that the best way to teach this king is through allegory, which is one of Narada's favorite teaching methods in general, and he's decided, now I'm going to try another one. And he's going to give a very brief one, which will be discussed tomorrow and the next day. Narada Uvacha, Prashna Eva Misanchino, Bhavata Purusharshaba, Atrame Vadato Guyam Nishamaya Sanishchitam. The great sage Narada continued, O great personality, I have replied properly about all that you have asked me. Now hear another narration that is accepted by saintly persons and is very confidential. So it seems that two things we're looking at here. One is the idea of the king giving up fruitive activity, and the other is him taking to the vanaprastha order. Both things we're looking at. And Narada was seeing that the king's acceptance of the vanaprastha order was indicative of his giving up fruitive activities. So why give up fruitive activities? I mean, here it's saying fruitive activities are a waste of time. So all of us want to enjoy some fruit. That's why we do things. What motivates our actions in this world is that we want to enjoy the fruit. Why do you plant a tree? Because you want to eat the fruit. Or you want to get some benefit. You want to get shade from the tree. Why do you build a house? Because you want to live in it. You know, everything we do, we're thinking, this thing I'm doing will achieve some result which I will then enjoy. It will give me some result that will satisfy me. It will give me some pleasure, it will give me some security, it will give me some knowledge, it will give me some something. It will make me feel that I'm doing something important, it will make me feel that I'm part of a community. Now we have some goal. And fruitive activity means, it's very much like planting a tree. I plant a seed, I wait for the tree to grow, the tree grows, it produces the fruit, I wait for the fruit to mature, I hope the birds don't get it, I hope the worms don't get it. I pick the fruit, I hope the fruit is sweet. And I eat the fruit. And then the season is over, and I've got to wait again for the next fruit. So, fruitive activity means that I'm spending most of my time waiting and planning. And every once in a while, I get to eat a fruit. And sometimes the fruit has a worm in it. And sometimes there just isn't any fruit. Sometimes you wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait, and there was an early frost, and there's just no fruit. So that's fruitive activity. Now, the soul is Ananta Chinmaya Rasa, as we were reading the other day. It's full of bliss. And fruitive activity means you're getting occasional, maybe, limited, maybe, happiness. Maybe. Maybe. Now, maybe there's not a worm in it. Maybe it's sweet. Maybe the birds don't run off with it. Maybe there was a news article recently that some thieves went to a vineyard in someplace in America, and they stole all the grapes. The farmer woke up in the morning just when he was ready to harvest them, and just one kind of grape. They just cleaned out all the grapes in the middle of the night. So when you're a fruitive worker, first of all, most of the time you're not happy. The vast majority of the time you're not happy. You're just anticipatory. I will be happy, I will be happy, I will be happy, I will be happy, I will be happy. And I remember that mistake I made in the past. And I'm not going to make that mistake again. Of course, we probably don't, but then we make a new mistake. You know, so one's lamenting about the past, all the times in the past where there wasn't any fruit, or the fruit had worms in it, or I planted the wrong tree, or I planted the tree in the wrong place, or the thieves came, or whatever. And we're trying to arrange it. So we're lamenting about the past, we're hankering for the future, and every once in a while we get some brief enjoyment in the present, which is over very quickly, and then again we're hankering for the future. So that's fruitive activities. It's not very satisfying. And of course it produces a lot of anger and frustration at anyone who gets in the way of me and my fruits. So this is not the natural condition of the soul. The natural condition of the soul is devotional service, where the happiness we're getting is from the service we're doing now, not from the result, over which we have very little control, and the result is really not for us to enjoy. All that austerity we do, really the fruit is for Krishna. So first we don't like that. We say, I do all the work, he gets the fruit. What kind of deal is that? But really, the fruit we're getting is constant, as explained in 424. The person, the offering, the sacrifice, everything becomes Brahman. And then the fruit is irrelevant. That's Krishna's business. You know, then the process of planting the seed, the process of watering the tree, the process of growing the tree, the process of waiting for the tree, the process of freaking the fruit out. All of that's being offered to Krishna. Everything's being offered to Krishna. And Krishna, and we're getting that reciprocation. And Hari Toshana, we're just thinking, is what I'm doing at this moment pleasing to Krishna? So that's devotional service. I'm trying to please Krishna now, and now, and now, and now, and now. In the spiritual world, there's no past and future. This past and future time thing, it's an illusion. And as soon as you're thinking in terms of past and future, then kartahamiti manyate, I'm the one planting the seed, I'm the one growing the tree, I should eat the fruit. But in real consciousness, I'm just acting as Krishna's instrument, and I'm acting just to reciprocate with Krishna, and everything I'm doing is pleasing to him. So that's the consciousness to which Narada Muni wants King Bharishvan to come. That's the point. Now, how do you get to that consciousness? So generally, how do you get from fruitive consciousness to transcendental consciousness, to devotional service consciousness, where my real fruit is that I'm meditating on Krishna moment by moment and offering things to Krishna moment by moment. So generally, there's a gradual process. And if we look at almost everything, we'll see that almost everything is gradual. Right? Growing up is gradual. Getting an education is gradual. Getting old is gradual. Right? It's always funny to me when I show people the BTG photo of when I was 25 on the roof of the New York Temple. And invariably people will say, is that you? You know, but I'm looking in the mirror every day and looks, you know, pretty close, unless I look at an old photo. The process of aging is very, very gradual. You don't notice it from one day to the next or one week to the next. You know, if you haven't seen somebody for 20 years, you meet them and you don't even recognize your old friend. You go, who's that middle-aged person walking over there? Oh, it's my old friend. And the process of gestation is gradual, 9 months pregnancy. Birth is almost always gradual. Death is generally gradual. When death is not gradual, then it's very traumatic. If someone has a sudden, unexpected death, it's very traumatic both for the person who dies. That's sometimes a cause of a person becoming a ghost. They don't even understand that they've died. And it's also very traumatic for the family. What else is gradual? And there's not only are things gradual, but there's almost always transitional times. So between day and night, there's a transition. Between the seasons, there's a transition. If we look at the system of Varna and Ashrama, particularly Ashrama, we'll find that there's transitional periods. Srila Prabhupada talks about the system of marriage. And he says how a very, very young boy and girl would often have a marriage, what we would consider really engagement. Very, very young. You know, the girl might be 5 and the boy might be 7 or 8. And the parents would arrange a marriage. But they wouldn't live together. He said they'd still stay at their parents' homes. And they'd meet sometimes with the family. And the family would say, oh, by the way, this is your husband. And this is your wife. And their relationship would develop very, very gradually. So they'd give a little girl some sweets. Here, why don't you give this to your husband? And then by the time that they reach maturity, they already had in their mind, this is my husband, this is my wife. And then there's another wedding when they're actually ready to live as husband and wife. So it was a very gradual thing. It wasn't like the kind of thing we did in ISKCON in the early days, that what one devotee called the deranged marriages. You know, okay, tomorrow's your wedding and there she is. And why did you decide I should marry that person? Well, you're tall and she's tall and I thought it would work out. that really happened. That actually really, really happened. So it was gradual. Prabhupada talked about once he got married even, his relationship with his wife. Because when he married, he was 22, she was 11. And he said, what does 11-year-old girl know about relations? He said, so first I just held her hand. He said, and then she started to cry. He said, so very, very gradually, he said, I started some intimate relation with my wife. Prabhupada gives us as an analogy for the process of bhakti. So there's some transition period. Right? Things are A, gradual, B, there's a transition. So there's a transition from brahmachari to grihastha. It's not like just one day you're a brahmachari, one day you're a grihastha. You get to know the person, you get to spend some time with them, you get to establish the relationship. There's a transition from grihastha to vanaprastha. Prabhupada talks about how the vanaprastha and his wife may travel to holy places for a few months, then come home, be with the children and the family again, go out traveling again. There's a transition period in sannyas. First of all, vanaprastha is itself a transition between grihastha and sannyas. But in sannyas, there's first you just move out of the house, right? You move to the edge of the village, and your children bring you food, or your family members bring you food. And then you start begging. You give up your dependence on the family, and you beg. Then you travel and preach. Then you live as a paramahansa. The Prabhupada says everyone should cleanse their heart by a gradual process, not abruptly. So we see these two things. Everything pretty much gradual and transition periods. I mean, even death. You know, if a person is destined to go from a human body to an animal body, first they go to the hellish planets, they're deconditioned, they're sort of deprogrammed, and they're reconditioned by Yamaraj to be prepared for their next body. So there's this transition period. The whole process of death and gestation in the womb is a kind of transition period from one life to the next, where you give up your memories of the previous life, and now you think, okay, now I'm this person. Now I have this identity. So this is how Krishna has arranged everything, with this gradual process. But now, of course, here we see something interesting, that Narada Muni is expecting the king to do it immediately. The king wants to do it gradually. He says, okay, now I've understood, but I'm going to transition here. I'm going to get my kids, I'm going to bring them back, I'm going to train them up, and then I'm going to leave. And Narada is saying, no, I want you to leave immediately. So although there's gradual and there's transition, when you're ready to take the step, there shouldn't be any hesitation. So one problem is thinking it shouldn't be gradual, there shouldn't be transitions, let me jump ahead and just do everything immediately without preparation. That's one kind of one cause of fall down, which we've seen so many times in ISKCON. So many times. You know, I'm 20 years old or 22 years old. Yes, I'm ready to be a lifelong renunciate. Let me jump without gradual, without transition, and then push. You know, here I am at the bottom step. I'm looking all at like those marble steps out there. Right? They're both gradual, and there's also a transition place when the stairs turn. So if someone says, well, I'm just going to jump up to the top step. So what are you going to do? You're going to crack your head on the marble. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Bhakti Loka and Niyamagraha, he says, you don't try to jump too fast. But another cause of fall down is going too slowly. That when you are ready to take the next step, you don't do it. And if you are ready to jump a few steps, you don't do that either. You say, oh, let me go slowly. So just like on the highway, I don't know what it's like here in Belgium, but in America, they have minimum and maximum speeds for the highway. You call them highways here?
Yeah.
UK, they call them motorways. I always have to change my English. So there's also a minimum speed. It may be a maximum speed of 70 miles an hour. And how many kilometers there is? 130, 140? Less? 120? So maybe a maximum speed 120 kilometers, but there's a minimum of 40 miles per hour. How many kilometers is that? 60? 65. So you have to be somewhere between 65 kilometers and 120. What happens if someone on the highway is going too slowly? They'll get hit from the back. So it's not only the fast cars that cause an accident. It's also the slow ones. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains very nicely. I would really highly recommend the little set. I highly recommend all of Bhakti Loka. It's a wonderful book. But especially the section on Niyamagraha. It only takes you 10, 15 minutes to read it. It's one of those real gems. You all know what Niyamagraha is? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Bhakti Loka, it's a commentary on the Upadeshamrita, text 3 and 4. So text 3 says what will hurt you, your progress in bhakti, and text 4, what will help your progress in bhakti. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur takes each of them and gives a long commentary. And he often writes how each one can be applied differently if you're a house order or a renunciate. Very nice instructions. So Niyamagraha can mean one of two things, whether it's Niyamagraha or Niyamagraha. It means either you don't follow the rules, or you follow them without knowing what the purpose of the rules are. You're missing the essence. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about that there's stairs. He says from getting from fruitive activity to devotional service, which is what we're talking about here, there's stairs. And each step has its rules. And when you're on a step, on a particular step, you have to know where you are, and you have to follow the rules for that step. And when you follow the rules for that step, that gives you the qualification for advancing to the next step. If you fall back a step, you become degraded. And he also says something that Srila Prabhupada quotes quite a bit, though not, he doesn't quote these exact words, but Srila Prabhupada refers to the statement a lot. He says, those who do not give up the rules of the previous level are bound by those rules like chains that do not allow you to proceed to the next level. Those who do not give up the rules of the previous level are bound by those rules like chains that do not allow him to proceed to the next level. So this was what was happening to King Bharishma. He wasn't giving up the rules and regulations of his previous level immediately. Oh, I'm in a transition period. And Narada was saying, you already understand. You already understand. You don't need any further transition. Now you're ready to do it. So the expert guru does both things, holds you back and pushes you forward. Says, all right, look, you're not ready to do this. I mean, there are people we have to advise, hey, you're not ready for renunciation, go get married. I was speaking with Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj a couple months ago about some devotee who I who comes to me for advice and doesn't listen to any of it. And I was asking him how to proceed, and he said, sometimes people need to get married. I said, yes, that's exactly what this person's situation is. But they refuse to do it. Oh no, I'm a renunciate. So sometimes you have to pull back on the reins and say, hey, you're trying to do something for which you're not qualified. Or like Prabhupada would sometimes stop people from just reading the Rasa-lila chapters. You know, the Gopi Bhava Club. Okay, well, the only thing we're going to read from Prabhupada's books is about Gopi Bhava. Prabhupada said, you are not qualified to do that. Pull them back. One devotee told me he wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada. How do you progress from Bhava to Prema? Prabhupada said, don't worry about this now. So sometimes the guru pulls you back, but sometimes the guru pushes you forward. Right? Sometimes you pull back on the rein, sometimes you whip the horse. And sometimes the guru says, wait a minute, you already understood this point, now go do it already. Don't act below your level of advancement, out of fear. When you're ready to do something, do it. Without any consideration, if you've already been through the steps, you've already been through the transition period. Now, Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says that those on a higher stage, he said, exalted devotees follow whatever rules of the lower stages they like. So when you're on a higher stage, you may, for some purpose in service, or he says for your own pleasure, follow some rule of the lower stage, but you're not bound by it. It's not something you're bound by. Like if you're teaching reading to young children, you don't say the cat's head on the mat. You say the cat sat on the mat. So those are the rules of the lower stage, but the teacher may adopt that in order to model for the children what they should do. Or there may be some purpose of service for which you apparently take the rule of the lower stage. Now, we should keep in mind here, again, that although King Bharishma would exhibit his giving up fruitive activities by taking to the vanaprastha order, it's not that those two things are always equivalent for everybody at every stage. So it's not that if I understand devotional service, I'm going to leave my family. We shouldn't make that equivalency. You know, we did that at one point in Krishna consciousness. And it's interesting, the analogy Narada is about to give is basically death is standing in front of you and behind you. And like in your essay, Rasmanda, where you talked about how in the early days of ISKCON, we used to tell people, you're going to die any minute. Leave your family, leave your job, leave the university, and move in the ashram now, immediately. And that was our preaching. So it's not necessarily that just because one becomes convinced to give up fruitive activities, that one immediately gives up one's family. That was the appropriate behavior for King Bharishman at his particular time of life. So what's the appropriate external manifestation of giving up fruitive activities for each student is going to vary according to that student's position and the circumstances. For Arjuna, his giving up fruitive activity involved doing the opposite. When Arjuna, the assessment procedure for whether or not Arjuna gave up fruitive activity and performed devotional service is that he didn't take up vanaprastha. That he stuck to his varna as a soldier, that he stayed in the grihastha ashram. So that's, sometimes we equate the two, that taking up vanaprastha or sannyas or becoming a brahmachari is the evidence of having understood that happiness doesn't come through fruits, happiness comes through devotional service. That's very individual. And that may change to different times. So at some time in our life, giving up fruitive activity may involve one kind of external behavior. And another time, giving up fruitive activity may involve manifestation of another external behavior. It's very individual and it's very changing. There was a time when Arjuna did give up the kingdom. Well, that time did come when the way he exhibited devotional service was by going to the Himalayas and leaving everything behind. So different manifestations at different times. So we should be examining our own life and saying, Am I acting honestly according to my realizations? Am I acting honestly according to my understanding? You know, I think many times in ISKCON we preach, don't jump ahead. Don't jump ahead. But the other instruction is, don't stay when you don't need to stay anymore. Now, what are we ready to do? How am I ready to surrender to Krishna? First question is, am I artificially imitating some level of surrender that I don't really have the realization for, that I can't really maintain out of pride? And the other question is, am I not taking a step out of fear? Now, of course, my experience is that if we don't take a step out of fear, that we've got at least Chaitanya Guru, he starts whipping you. You know, he starts saying, come on, come on. Because that's the position of the Guru. It's the position of Guru and Krishna, that if you don't take the step you should take, they're going to push you. So better to be an intelligent student, to understand, what is it I understand? What's my level of realization? On what level am I functioning? What's the appropriate behavior? What's the appropriate way for me to exhibit surrender in my situation? Am I doing the maximum that I can do according to my level of realization? And am I being honest and not jumping ahead? So if we do that, then our relationship with our spiritual masters and Krishna will be very, very sweet. If any of us have experienced sometimes that Krishna teaches us in ways that aren't very pleasant, that means that we're not responding. And Narada Muni gave a reasonably pleasant analogy, but I tell you, this analogy he's going to give in tomorrow's verse is not very pleasant. It's a very heavy analogy. He's pushing harder. He's saying, you're a fool, and you're about to die. Come on, move. So if we want to have Krishna, Guru, the Acharyas, deal with us in a kindly way, then we should be very good students. And we should take our act always according to understand our level of understanding honestly, which requires some humility, and act accordingly. So thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yes,
ma'am. You spoke about the kinds of the motivations one may have, such as to look good in the community, or to get a post, service, which seem to go along with the perhaps more sincere motivations that we have to please the Vaishnavas and Krishna, Guru and Krishna. So, is there anything else we can do other than just trying to notice the different kinds of motivation that is going on inside of us?
Well, let's look ahead. Time is running away. But one way we can look at this is in terms of the yoga ladder, which really takes you from food of activity to bhakti. So my first answer to your question would be that all of the things that I want to achieve through material fruits, I should have, and I talked about this the other day, I should have the faith that I am going to achieve all those in perfection by devotional service. So, you know, wanting to be part of a community and have some standing in a community, where does that desire come from? That desire comes from the fact that I'm a resident of Goloka Vrindavan and I have a community there. I have my eternal family. I have my eternal group. Krishna lives in a community. He doesn't just live in the white light. And this desire for a community and to have some position in that community is really ultimately a spiritual desire. It's really a desire for my swarup. It's really a desire to know my identity. So you can look at all material desires like that, because in one sense there is no such thing as a material desire. Material desire means I'm taking a spiritual desire and I'm seeing it separate from Krishna. That's all. The material doesn't come up with something new. It's just taking what's there and it's twisting it. It's the reflection of the banyan tree. So you can look at all material desires and see really how is this, what is the original spiritual desire? And then see, oh, the real way I'm going to get this desire fulfilled is by surrendering to Krishna. And as you see that, then gradually, and you see that the material fruits don't actually give it to me. Conversely, I don't really get that desire fulfilled materially. It doesn't work. Because it's artificial. My concept of community is artificial. And my concept of my position in the community is artificial. It's temporary and it's external. And therefore, it's on a shaky platform, and I'm always worried about how am I going to maintain it? How am I going to create it? How am I going to maintain it? It's mostly just anxiety. Then when you see that, you say, okay, instead of working for that, why don't I just work to please Krishna? Why don't I just work to meditate on making Krishna happy about whatever I'm doing? And Krishna will take care of my community, even on the material platform. I'm sure you've all had experiences like this, but I had such a sweet experience in New Zealand. So it was my birthday, and I thought, this must have been pre-Facebook when everyone knows when your birthday is, but it was my birthday, and I thought, you know, no one's going to know it's my birthday. And New Zealand, you're a day ahead of America. So nobody, none of my relatives would call me till the next day. Do you understand? Okay. When it's Thursday in New Zealand, it's Wednesday in America. So I thought, nobody's going to wish me happy birthday. Nobody's going to notice. Nobody cares. And I was lamenting. I was sitting in my room like, oh. And as I was sitting there lamenting, it was probably about 6 or 7 in the evening. So, you know, that's on my door. And this young couple who've been helping me a lot in New Zealand, Dharma Sethu and Karna Karna, they knock on my door and they bring me this birthday cake. I said, how did you know it was my birthday? He said, well, I've been helping you get your visa. So I noticed your birthday written down there. And I said to him, here I'm away from my sons and daughter. Krishna sent me another son and daughter to wish me a happy birthday. And I thought, thousands and thousands and thousands of experiences that I've had, where you just see that Krishna takes care even of your material things. Prabhupada would talk about that. He left his family. He said, I gave up my sons and daughters, and Krishna's giving me thousands of sons and daughters. And that we really don't need to make an extraneous endeavor to satisfy our needs. If I surrender to Krishna, Krishna really does take care, and he even takes care of the stupid little material desires, like I wanted somebody to remember my birthday. What a stupid thing. But still, Krishna's so affectionate. You know, he's so caring and he's so loving that he even takes care of that kind of thing. Especially when you let go, and when you just say, okay, Krishna, I'm not going to worry about those things anymore. I'm just going to surrender to you. You know, he takes care of things like that. He really does. And then that's a moment. Then one starts feeling that all of one's needs are met moment by moment by moment. Materially, it's like, okay, I'm going to do this to meet my needs. Oh, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But if I surrender to Krishna, it's a constant thing. Now, what's the gradual process for that? If we look at the yoga ladder, so first you're just like an animal. You just do anything to meet your needs. You do any sinful activity. And then you come to Karmakanda platform, where you say, okay, I'm going to try to get my fruits. I'm still looking for my fruit, but I'm going to try to get it in a pious way, in an ethical way. I'm going to get it by following the Shastra. Now, that means that you're performing jagya. Pious means I pay for things, right? So vikarma, I'm stealing. Vikarma, I'm just going to the trees and stealing somebody else. I go to someone's vineyard and I steal the grapes in the middle of the night. And karmakanda is, I do the work, I do the sacrifice, I pay my taxes. So my interest is still the fruits. My whole interest is the fruits. And I'm still thinking I'm the doer, but I recognize I've got to pay God. So I'm doing some sacrifice, that's karmakanda. Then sakam karma yoga, I still am interested in the fruits. I still want to enjoy the fruits. I'm still identifying fruits as my enjoyment, but I'm starting to have some desire to connect with Krishna. I'm not treating him like a shop anymore. I just pay the shop and I get my food and I leave. And I don't give one fig about the people in the shop. So now I'm starting to get a relationship with the shopkeeper. So that's sakam karma yoga. But I'm going to the shop to buy things, but I also am starting to like the shopkeeper. Then nishkam karma yoga, I'm not so interested in the buying things anymore. I'm interested in my relationship, starting to get interested in my relationship with the shopkeeper. So I'm still engaged in ordinary activities in the world, but I'm starting to relish my sacrifice. I'm starting to relish the sacrifice itself and the work itself that I'm doing. Then we come up to Gyan Yoga. Gyan Yoga is, it all starts to be about relationship. That, oh, I'm just a soul and I have a relationship with Krishna. I'm starting to really relish not just even the work I'm doing, not the sacrifice I'm making. So first I'm relishing the fruits independently as a thief. Then I'm relishing the fruits legally. Then I'm relishing the fruits and I'm grateful to the shopkeeper. I'm not just paying the shopkeeper, I'm grateful. Then I'm relishing the work, that I'm relishing the sacrifice. Then I'm relishing my relationship with Krishna. Then after a while, it doesn't really matter. All I'm caring about is Krishna's pleasure. So then I come from Gyan Yoga to Dhyan Yoga. I'm meditating now on Krishna. Then it comes to bhakti. I'm meditating on Krishna with love. And then I find that, oh, Krishna is the real fruit. No? And that's there always expanding and expanding and expanding. So that's the yoga ladder. And you can see it's mostly a matter of changing consciousness more than changing activity. Although at the platform of Gyan Yoga and Dhyan Yoga, the activities may also significantly change. So we have time maybe for one more group. Is that all right? Did I?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was thinking we are advised to be very careful to recognize say the weeds around the creeper of devotional service, and sometimes different things may externally look like devotional service, but they can have different motives and they can kind of... So I was thinking maybe you can help us by telling us a little bit of how this fruitive mentality can take the garb of devotional service, and how in devotional service even itself, can one still have this remnant of the smell of the fruitive consciousness, even thinking about having spiritual fruit, but still the consciousness is not to please at all, it's more to get the so that's kind of my...
Devotees are so wonderful. You know, a lot of times we have so many difficulties in this society of devotees, especially those of us who've been hanging around for a long time. And sometimes we may think about all the difficulties and all the ways people have mistreated us or cheated us or all of the... Especially I just finished teaching the ISKCON history course. You know, all this problem and that problem. But when I hear a question like that, I am so glad I'm coming to the Association of Devotees. What a wonderful question. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And it makes me really grateful to Srila Prabhupada for having established this society. It makes me grateful to all the administrators here who are running the temple, to all the people who are running the college, to all the people who are helping and guiding all of us, that produces someone who asks a question. So I'd say that there's... it seems to me you're asking on two levels. So one is the fruitive mentality in general, Krishna consciousness. Oh, for sure. You know, instead of thinking, I'm going to build this house so I'll enjoy, I think I'm going to build this temple for Krishna and then I'll enjoy. That we start seeing. And Jiva Goswami explains that this mentality is the effect of intentional inattentive chanting. And I would broaden that to intentional inattentive anything. Because it's not that I can be attentive when I'm chanting and inattentive while I do everything else. One thing Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in the section is remembering of Krishna is supposed to proceed at all levels, at all stages, no matter what you're doing. Not that when you're a neophyte, you're not supposed to remember Krishna. So this concept that my happiness comes from results and then I am the doer and that I am the enjoyer of those results and that we measure, Jiva Goswami is saying, we're measuring our advancement in terms of our external accomplishments. So I think that what my pleasure in Krishna consciousness comes from how many books I've distributed, how many students are coming to the college, whether or not the college is financially stable, how big the building is, how many buildings have we built. You know, when I'm connecting my happiness to those things, I will be happy when we get triple the number of students. I will be happy once the new building is finished. I will be happy once I've distributed 20 books. That's entirely free of mental. Now, that may be karma yoga. It may be sakam karma yoga. In fact, that is sakam karma yoga. I'm still attached to the fruits. I still want to enjoy the fruits. I still identify my happiness as the fruits. I still think that I'm the doer. But I have some sense that I'm supposed to be sacrificing for Krishna. I don't really like Krishna yet. I don't really have a relationship with Krishna. So that is sakam karma. We expect that people will start at sakam karma yoga. That's to be expected. We don't expect that people are going to start at prema bhakti. But we should endeavor, what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, is by following the rules of each step, you become qualified to take the next step. So if that's the platform that we're on, then at least sacrifice everything for Krishna. That will qualify you to come to Nishkam Karma. And the other way of seeing the fruit is thinking also, fruit of mentality is very future. One way you can tell fruit of mentality, it's very future oriented. There's no future in the spiritual world, my friends. If we are future-oriented, we are not in Krishna consciousness, because there is no future in the spiritual world. It's always the present. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, forget the past, the sleeps, and the other future, dream at all the various times that are with thee in progress, they shall call. So that's one way you can tell that the weed is there. Now, of course, sometimes we have to think about the future in the sense that, you know, I just got this email, okay, we're going to start our devotee care seminars on such and such a date. Can you buy your ticket? And today I have to work at buying the ticket. But future-oriented in the sense that my happiness is in the future. And because there's no such thing as the future, it's never the future. It's never the future. If my happiness is invested in the future, what am I going to be? Unhappy. I must be. Occasionally, my anticipated future happiness exists in the present. So the primary way of recognizing fruit of mentality is, does my happiness exist in the future? And when I get happiness from some fruit, is a lot of my happiness that I'm the doer. I did this. I got more students to come to the college. I made this subject. I built this building. I wrote this book. I did it. That sense of accomplishment and achievement, which is a perversion of our spiritual desire for meaning and significance. Because Krishna loves me. And then, yeah, we can do it with things relating to our own personal advancement, not just to external things like a building built or an essay completed. We can do it too. I will be happy when I attain Nishta. I will be happy when I attain Bhava. Right now I'm suffering like a dog, but you know, when I attain some higher stage of Krishna consciousness, then I will be happy. Guess what? Kevala Nandakanda. You can be happy even as a neophyte. Isn't that cool? We are not a suffer now, enjoy later religious philosophy. Why not find, even if you have a little bit of bhakti, even if right now, like according to Madhuri Kanambani, in the beginning, there's just a tiny trace. You know, that's nice. Celebrate your trace that you have right now. Because, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, by following the rules of this step, it qualifies me for the next step. That means my attention should be on doing what I'm supposed to be doing now. And that's enough. And of course, noticing when I'm supposed to make the next step. Relishing, what is Krishna giving me now? Imagine if you give somebody a gift and all they say is, what's the next gift you're going to give me? That's not very pleasing to Krishna. What realizations has he given us now? What little bits of reciprocation is he giving us now? How am I tasting a little bit of the sweetness of Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes now? Yes, it may be very immature and very beginning and lamentably full of all sorts of anarthas, but boy, it's still nice. And just imagine, if it's so nice now, what is real Krishna consciousness? So celebrate whatever Krishna has given you now. That's the cure for that kind of fruit of mentality. Celebrate it. If you celebrate the gifts Krishna's given you now, you know he'll probably be likely to give you more. And if you really want to advance, then take full advantage of what you have right now. So many times, you know, we just, oh, if only I were in that position. That's another manifestation. I can't be Krishna conscious now. That was Varishman's, King Varishman's thing. He said, okay, I've understood Narada's instructions. I'll follow them after my sons come back. First I have to do this and 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 this, and then I can act according to my realizations. So that's another kind of future, future, future. No, act according to your realizations now. Relish them now. And I mean now. I don't mean just this week or today. I mean now. Beep, beep. That's the cure. Is that all right? And you know what? You know what happens if you do that? Then nobody can take your happiness away. If your happiness is dependent on fruits, then it's so conditional. It's so conditional to your health, to your environment, to how other people treat you, to the weather, to, you know, everything. And if your happiness is in your relationship with Krishna and pleasing Hare Krishna, samsiddhi halitoshanam, the perfection of whatever you're doing is this Krishna pleasing, then it's yours. It's yours. You can control that. You have it at any moment. You have it in every circumstance. Ahoituki pratyanta. It can never be taken away. It can never be constrained by anything. Of course, then you can't blame anybody else either. So that's the downside, is you can't blame anybody else. What you lose by doing that, you know, you can say, well, why don't we just do that? The price is, I have to give up this idea that I'm a victim. I can't get the satisfaction of blaming my lack of happiness on other people, or ultimately on God. You know, I can't get that sort of mode of ignorance pleasure. And I have to give that up and say, hey, you know, I'm the one responsible for what I have. So thank you very much. All the ways to Shul.